accession number 20624, reel 1.
Colonel John McGregor interviewing Colonel David of Bathnott on the 21st of March 2000.
22nd.
David, where and when were you born?
I was born in Colchester, in Essex, in November 1927. And the reason I was born in Colchester was because the 2nd Battalion, the Black Watch, was stationed there, and my father was the adjutant at the time. And we moved shortly after that. I remember a long train. Well, wait a minute. I've got all that wrong. The date I was born is right, but of course I was born there because my mother's family came from Colchester, and I'm mixing up the dates. It was when my sister was born in 1932 that my father was adjutant of the 2nd Battalion in Colchester. I was born in Colchester because my mother's home was in Dedham in Essex, not far from Colchester. So anyway, there's the answer to the first question.
Slightly the same longer. Question you've answered, that your father was a regular soldier in the army.
Correct.
In the Black Watch.
Right.
Where did you go to school?
I was first at school, at a prep school in England, near Wellington College, not far from Sandhurst, not far from the Staff College, called Eagle House. And my father has always said that he sent us, the three of us, three boys there, because when he was playing hockey for the Staff College, that was the place where they got the best tea. So he sent his sons to that school. Then in 1941, I moved to Fettes in Edinburgh and was there throughout the war.
What were your favourite subjects at school?
Well, I was on the classical side, so I had no choice. I had to like Latin and Greek. I enjoyed them anyway, in fact. I enjoyed all forms of sport. I was lucky enough to be quite capable at them all, and therefore made them even more enjoyable. The Corps, I don't remember much about. Everybody was in the Corps. It was in the war. Corps, I should say, of course, is what was now called the Combined Cadet Force. It was then called the Junior Training Corps, the JTC. I enjoyed that too. We used to go up onto the Pentland Hills for our exercises, and otherwise training was done within the grounds of Fettes, which were quite big enough to hold small size exercises.
At what age did you realise that your future was going to be in the army?
Well, I suppose all the way through the war I knew that the time would come when I would be called up and have to join up. In fact, I defeated the system by volunteering, because if you volunteered before you were called up, you were then guaranteed the regiment that you asked for. If you were called up, you could be sent anywhere.
Indeed, I asked which regiment you
were. It was the Black Watch, naturally enough, because of my father's connection. And in fact, I was very lucky, because at that time the recruiting officer in the assembly rooms in Edinburgh, where all the army recruiting was done in George Street, was one Charlie Scott, well-known to Black Watch people, a well-known regimental sergeant major in the First War, and then after that a well-known quartermaster. And of course, when I appeared in front of him to volunteer to enlist, he immediately, seeing the name and knowing the connection, put me down for the Black Watch without me even having to say so. So that was me for the Black Watch. That was in late 45, when I must have been 17 and a half, and I stayed on at Fettes to the end of 45, and went off to Cameron Barracks, Inverness, in January 1946. Cameron Barracks, Inverness, was then the home of the 30th Training Battalion, and in those days, I think there were four, maybe three, 27, 28, 29, and 30, I suppose, training battalions, and these were leader training battalions. People who were likely to become NCOs or officers were sent to these training battalions rather than to the primary training units. For instance, the depot at Queen's Barracks in Perth was 42 PTU, I suppose. Anyway, if you were in your enlistment papers, and then the little exam that you did, if it was thought that you might make NCO or officer material, you were picked out and sent off to one of these training battalions. One was in Northern Ireland, one in Elgin, one in Inverness rather, and I suppose the other two were in England. And at this training battalion, young men for all the Scottish regiments and some Northern England regiments were sent, all infantry, of course. And there I stayed, Cameron Barracks, Inverness, in the 30th Training Battalion until the midsummer of 1946, when the whole battalion moved out from Cameron Barracks and went along the coast to Elgin, Pinefield Camp Elgin, which is now gone, disappeared. From my initial recruit training company, I was moved to a potential officer company, and from there went to the War Office Selection Board in just outside Edinburgh. It was a former anti-aircraft position on the road out to Dalkeith. No, beyond Dalkeith, on the hill up out of Dalkeith. There I was graded NY3 or NY6, I suppose it was, which meant not yet, try again in 6 months. And so I went back to the 30th Training Battalion. As a little aside, of course, the fact that I wasn't selected straight away meant that I was there at the right moment when Sandhurst was restarted. If I had been selected for officer training in that summer of 46, I would have gone to Octu and been commissioned probably by the end of the year. Instead of that, of course, I had to wait until January 1947, when Sandhurst started, and do my 18 months at Sandhurst, so I wasn't in fact commissioned until the middle of 1948. But prior to going to Sandhurst, back to 1946, all the young aspirants who put their names down for Sandhurst were thought they needed some educational bumping up. So we all went off to a big house. Oh, heavens, I can't remember its name now, just outside Dalkeith, New Battle Abbey, which was an educational forcing house for young men in the army. And we had the most marvellous time there because it was, in spite of having a very nice company sergeant major in the Argylls who tried to control us, we really had very little drill and discipline, and we were there purely for academic reasons. So as soon as we'd finished our so-called studies, we were all off to Edinburgh on the bus or the back of somebody's bicycle. And how we got away with doing so little for so long, I don't know. But anyway, that came to an end. There was no form of examination or anything at the end. And off we went to Sandhurst in the January of 1947, which many people remember was one of the coldest winters that have been. We started off then at Sandhurst, and as I say, for 18 months. And I was in the first intake at Sandhurst, intake one, sometimes known as the guinea pigs, and I think we must have had a very cushy time compared with everybody else because there was nobody above us. There were no senior cadets. We were the first people there, and therefore as new intakes arrived, intake 1A, then 2, then 3, I think, we moved up the scale and became the senior cadets all the time. So we had, as I say, a very cushy time. Also, as we were being, we were an experimental group. People hadn't really worked out exactly what was required at Sandhurst, and I think again we probably had an easier time than most when the system got going properly and everybody became clear as to exactly what young officers should be taught. So there we were at Sandhurst until July 1948, when the first post-war passing out parade took place, and I went off to the 1st Battalion and having spent a short time, couple of nights or something, at the depot in Perth, then up to Fort George, which was then occupied by the 1st Battalion, the Highland Light Infantry, who were the Highland Brigade Training Battalion. So they didn't have an operational role at all. They were simply there to give continuation training to young men going to all the Highland regiments. And young officers for all the Highland regiments went there for about a week or a fortnight, I think, until we were drafted out to our own battalions, wherever they were. In this case, the first Black Watch, who were in Duisburg, on the Rhine in Germany, not far from Dusseldorf. I arrived there in September 48 to start my career as a young officer in the Black Watch. Pause for breath. So I think I've got location and date I've given, September of 1948 we've got to, and Duisburg. I joined D Company, and I was very lucky to have as my company commander Major Sandy Leslie, A.W. Leslie, who won an MC with the 5th Battalion, a very well decorated and very brave wartime officer, and a very good trainer of men and young officers. Shortly before I arrived, the battalion had been receiving its first intake of national servicemen, and therefore I moved to, I suppose it was 12th Platoon of D Company, which was a platoon of young men who were all national servicemen. The NCOs were more or less all regulars, and some of the Lance Corporals would have been national servicemen, and what a very fine bunch of young men they were. There must have been a number of regulars. I think support company was largely regulars, headquarter company regulars, but the bulk of the battalion were national servicemen doing their 2 years' service. So there in Germany it was all training of various scales, from platoon training up to divisional exercises, when the whole battalion would go and join the 6th Brigade, of which the battalion was part, 6th Infantry Brigade. For a time it was the 6th Highland Brigade, because the Gordons and ourselves were in the brigade, so with two Highland battalions it called itself the Highland Brigade, and had a Highland Brigadier, McNab, John, Brigadier John McNab, who was a Cameron, I think. So there we were at Duisburg training. One unusual thing that I personally didn't get involved in, but a company at a time, and I think when I arrived it was C Company, was a thing called Operation Woodpecker. And there, complete companies from battalions all over the British Army of the Rhine went off to cut trees. And this was part of reparations. Whole miles, square miles of German forestry were chopped down by the British Army, and the wood, I suppose, went off to be pit props in Britain or something like that. Anyway, these companies were away on this Operation Woodpecker for about 6 months at a time. Nothing military about it at all. They just went off and became lumberjacks. But that's just a little interesting aside of something that's not often thought about. Exercises, I suppose, are the main point. And sometimes, of course, we did exercises with other nations, the French, I remember, in particular, also a national service army. But we didn't think quite so keen on realism as we were. I remember moving through a French defensive position, and these young French soldiers, instead of digging a slit trench, had just arranged a little line of stones to indicate the outlines of the trench. Very sensible, because it saved an awful lot of hard work. In any case, they were probably moving on in an hour or so. What are the other things? Driving about in three-ton lorries, open three-ton lorries, and those in the part of Germany we were operating, the roads were all lined with apple trees, and so the great game was, as soon as the convoy stopped, to lift your hand up from the open three-tonner and pick a raw apple off a tree and end up with a tummy ache. Guest nights, I suppose, was another highlight, and I remember that marvellous Black Watch officer, Alec Brodie, taking me on my first guest night to the Gordon Highlanders. And he looked after me most beautifully. He was determined that the Gordon Highlanders wouldn't get hold of me and pickle me or make me tight. And he was forever giving me advice in the car going there and throughout the evening to watch these Gordons and not to have too much to drink. And he was forever there at my shoulder to make sure that I was being properly looked after and not... the Gordons weren't taking me for a ride. Marvellous man, and the kindest of senior officers to young men that I've ever known. Sandy Leslie went after a time. I think he went off to be training major of the TA battalion. He may have gone to a staff job. And Freddie Burnaby Atkins came as his replacement. Another wonderful man, although quite a different war record, because he, poor man, was captured in St. Valery and spent the whole war in a prisoner of war camp. And so he quite openly admitted to us when he arrived that he had as much to learn as we had, because he knew nothing of modern soldiering. However, we all got on very well together. Vogelsang was one of the training areas we went to. That was down to the south, I suppose, in the Harz... No, not the Harz Mountains. Down towards the French frontier, I suppose. I can't remember exactly. The reason I mentioned it was because that was my one meeting with Field Marshal Wavell when I was a platoon commander on exercise in Vogelsang, and he came down to visit the battalion, and I had a short conversation with him on the side of the road. And that was my one meeting with that wonderful chap. Commanding officer, I should have mentioned long ago, Bernard Ferguson, the most unorthodox of soldiers, and in the happy position of not having to care a hoot about his military career. And so he just really did what he wanted. One of his wonderful idiosyncrasies was never to wear a battle dress jacket until one day at a divisional parade, he had to, for the first time, take off his service dress jacket and put on a battle dress jacket. That was the one time I've ever seen him wearing battle dress, which was, of course, was the normal dress for the rest of us, battle dress jacket and a kilt. That particular parade was at another training area called Sennelager, and Sennelager had a long airstrip, beautifully built airstrip of not cobbles, but bricks. And the whole of the 2nd Division paraded down this airstrip. I can't remember why we did it. It was just a sort of show of strength, I suppose. And for this occasion, we became very Germanic, and we marched by companies in blocks. It was the whole battalion in a block, because all the officers were in front, and then the whole battalion in a block, rather as you see Russian and German parades all goose-stepping along. So we went goose-stepping past, I can't remember who took the salute, I don't think it was the divisional commander, and to make it even more Germanic and continental, we all had to wear a tin hat, a battle dress jacket with our webbing equipment, kilt, boots and putties. A very fine sight we were. And of course, being the Black Watch, we burnished the tin hats, painted them black, shined the little rim thing to a bright shiny silver, and every man had a little clip soldered onto the left hand side of his tin hat and a red hackle stuck in the little clip. So there we were. There are photographs of this impressive impressive mass of people marching past. It's the only time I've ever taken part in a parade like that, but it was very unusual for the British Army to march in that sort of formation. These are really just highlights of things that I remember of our time in Duisburg as part of the 2nd Division. one other little incident was Field Marshal Montgomery had become the Chief of General Staff. Well, he was Chief of the Imperial General Staff in those days, CIGS, and he was to arrive at Dusseldorf Airport, which was about 10 miles down the road from Duisburg, I suppose, and Ian Critchley, who was another platoon commander in D Company, in fact, I think at the time he was probably company second in command, he was detailed to produce a guard of honour for Field Marshal Montgomery. So all the pick of D Company were taken out and drilled and smartened up, and under Ian Critchley produced the guard of honour for Field Marshal when he arrived. The dregs of D Company were handed over to 2nd Lieutenant Arbuthnot, and we were told to do a route march from the barracks. The others, of course, had gone by truck. So we marched away down the road to Dortmund, and there we were told to stand on the far side of the airfield and watch the ceremony. So we shambled along after our 10-mile route march and formed ourselves up, we hoped inconspicuously. And to our horror, though, after the Field Marshal had inspected the Guard of Honour, he decided to come across and see the rest of the company. So there we were being inspected by the Field Marshal. I don't think he said very much to us. I don't remember about it. But that was my I think, my one introduction and meeting with Field Marshal Montgomery on Dusseldorf airstrip in command of the rest of D Company. From Duisburg, I must get my dates right, I suppose it was 1949. Sorry, just to go back a second, all the time we were in Duisburg, of course, the Berlin airlift was going on, when the Berlin was cut off by land and everything had to come and go by air. And shortly after the airlift ended and the siege was raised, the battalion was sent on a battalion posting from Duisburg to Berlin, away from 6th Brigade, to become part of British Troops Berlin, which then was, and I don't think it ever changed, was in a brigade strength, three battalions, I think a squadron of tanks, I don't think there was any artillery, and the garrison, the British garrison of Berlin. So off we went by train from Duisburg to Berlin and took up our residence in a barracks way down at a place beyond the Gatow airfield, Montgomery Barracks it was called, but not far from Field Marshal Montgomery. I think that was because the first British troops into Berlin were Welsh division, and it was Montgomery the Welsh country rather than Montgomery the Irish, I think, general, Field Marshal. So there we were, Montgomery Barracks, Gatow, right on the very edge of the British zone, not zone, British sector. The zone was the phrase used for the area of West Germany that British had. The British sector was the area of Berlin, quite separate from the zone, where the British occupied, along with the French, Americans and Russians. But this bit of the British sector was right against the Russian zone. And so what the perimeter wire of the barracks was in fact the frontier between the British sector and the Russian zone. And so on our side of the fence we had battalion sentries patrolling the battalion the barracks perimeter, on the other side were Russian patrols patrolling their zone. In those days it wasn't so fortified or barricaded as it became later, and it not that we were allowed to, but it would have been possible to walk across into the Russian zone. The only person that that's telling tales out of school. One person did stray across, but was returned quite safely. Perhaps I can tell the story, because it also affects my first cousin, Pinky Hamilton, Colonel Adrian Hamilton's daughter and sister of Bruce Hamilton, later to become a brigadier in the Black Watch. Well, Pinky was walking out with Ian Critchley that I've mentioned before, and she must have come to Berlin to stay with him, or in those days, of course, she'd be properly staying with some officer's wife and meeting him at appropriate occasions, but the two of them decided to go off for a picnic, and one way and another they managed to stray in their picnic out of the British sector. And there was a slight kerfuffle, but they returned quite quickly, I think probably because of Ian Critchley's quickness of tongue. He probably talked himself out of the difficult position quite quickly. I must tell another story about Ian Critchley, because just outside the barracks there was a crossroads. And this is a little difficult to describe, but two sides of the crossroads were in the British sector, and two sides of the crossroads, the two roads of the crossroads, were in the Russian zone. And there came a time that a slight crisis arose, because the Russians decided that they thought the whole of the centre of the crossroads belonged to them, whereas we insisted that half of it was ours. And Ian Critchley was sent with a line of with some men from the Black Watch to make sure that we maintained our half of the crossroads. And so the jocks were lined up diagonally across the crossroads, and a Russian came along and put his foot down in the middle of the crossroads, Russian officer, and said, "This is the Russian bit." But Ian Critchley said, no, I'm going to draw a white line to indicate the boundary. So he took out his white paint and started painting along the exactly across the middle of the crossroads and to where the Russian was standing with his boot firmly planted in the middle. So, unperturbed, Ian simply continued the white line over the toe of the Russian's boot and on across to the other corner of the crossroads. It's a silly story, but it was indicative of the sort of crises we were involved in, which nowadays mean absolutely nothing, but at the time appeared to be matters of life and death. The way in and out of Berlin, you could either drive up the Autobahn, and you couldn't stray from it. You had to stay on the Autobahn, and you were checked in at one end and checked at the other to make sure that you didn't stray off. Or there was the train, the military train, and one of the duties of the officers in the battalion, in all battalions in Berlin, was to be the train commander. So every now and then you were told it was your due turn for train commander. And it was a very easy journey. You had a nice sleeping compartment, and you went down to the British zone and then came back on the next train. I suppose there was a train went each way every night, probably. I think they ran, whether there were anybody travelling or not, just to ensure that the right was maintained to run these trains backwards and forwards. Can we stop there for a moment while I gather my...